Diese Episode wird präsentiert von Brain Effect, dem Anbieter hochwertiger Nahrungsergänzungsmittel aus Berlin-Weißensee. Brain Effect stellt Performance Food her, das die mentale Performance und Leistungsfähigkeit steigert. Dabei sind alle Produkte natürlicher Herkunft. Die Produkte von Brain Effect können zum Beispiel hilfreich sein, wenn wir uns nach einem langen Flug in eine andere Zeitzone rascher an die örtliche Zeitzone gewöhnen und weniger lange unter Jetlag leiden möchten. Oder wenn wir unseren Körper nach einer intensiven Trainingseinheit bei der Regeneration unterstützen wollen. Das hätte meinem heutigen Gast, Laura Decker, womöglich gelegentlich auch gute Dienste geleistet. Infos dazu und den entsprechenden Shop gibt es auf der Website braineffect.com. Und Hörerinnen und Hörer von Weltwach erhalten auf ihre Bestellung 20% Rabatt. Dazu müsst ihr im Bezahlprozess einfach den Gutscheincode WELTWACH20 eingeben. Weltwach als Wort, 20 als Ziffer, ohne Leerzeichen dazwischen. WELTWACH20.
I remember very well, like a night where there was absolutely no wind and the stars were reflecting into the ocean, and it kind of feels like you're sailing through space or something with stars above you and under you, and they're all so bright, or the boat smashing through a storm in full moon while phosphorus is just all around the boat glowing up green. There's such special moments that even if there's really bad moments that are so special, that just makes everything good.
Legendäre Grenzgänger und leidenschaftliche Weltenwanderer nehmen uns mit auf ihre Streifzüge und bieten Einblicke in ferne Orte und faszinierende Kulturen. Mit offenen Augen ins Abenteuer. Das ist der Weltwach-Podcast mit Erik Lorenz.
Mein heutiger Gast hat als jüngster Mensch der Welt eben jene Welt umsegelt, Laura Decker. Und sie hat genau das im Alter von 14 bis 16 Jahren allein bewerkstelligt. Das ist jetzt schon einige Jahre her und in diesem Gespräch blickt Laura auf dieses Abenteuer und auf ihre Erziehung zurück, auf all die Dinge, die sie so weit gebracht haben, sich für ein solches Abenteuer bereit zu fühlen. Wir sprechen auch darüber, wie diese Erfahrung sie geprägt hat und wie sie ihre Erkenntnisse daraus heute im Bildungsbereich nutzen will. Bevor es losgeht, noch zwei Hinweise. Erstens, dies hier ist mal wieder eine englischsprachige Show. Sie erscheint parallel auch in unserem neuen Podcast Unfolding Maps. Zur Erinnerung, beziehungsweise für diejenigen unter euch, die es noch nicht mitbekommen haben, wir haben kürzlich einen neuen Podcast gelauncht mit dem gleichen Konzept wie Weltwach, nur eben komplett auf Englisch. Der Name der Show lautet, wie gesagt, Unfolding Maps. Dies hier ist bis auf Weiteres die letzte Folge, die in beiden Shows parallel erscheint. Das heißt, fortan findet ihr Interviews mit internationalen Autoren, Abenteurern, Fotografen etc. nur noch bei Unfolding Maps. Ich würde mich sehr freuen, wenn ihr auch diese Show unterstützt und abonniert. Und ich freue mich, wenn sie euch gefällt, sehr über eine kurze Rezension und Bewertung in der Apple Podcast App. Zweitens, uns stehen dieses Jahr einige Weltwach-Live-Veranstaltungen bevor, von denen ich hoffe, dass sie euch gefallen werden. Los geht's wenige Tage nach Erscheinen dieser Folge im März 2020 auf der ITB in Berlin, kurz darauf dann in Düsseldorf mit Dirk Rohrbach, im April wieder in Düsseldorf mit Christine Thürmer und im Oktober in Schwerte bei Dortmund mit niemand Geringerem als Reiseautor und Gast der ersten und 100. Weltwach-Folge, unter anderem Andreas Altmann. Worauf ich mich aber ganz besonders freue, ist ein neues, eigenes, kleines Festival, das Weltwach gemeinsam mit dem Kunterbundhof von André Schumacher in Mecklenburg-Vorpommern veranstaltet. André Schumacher war bereits in zwei Folgen bei Weltwach zu Gast, und zwar in Folge 92 und 97. In letzterer geht es zum Beispiel darum, wie er mit seiner Frau und Kleinkind via Lastenfahrrad einmal quer durch Europa geradelt ist. Vielleicht erinnert ihr euch. Wir laden nun auf seinen wundervollen Hof ein, der ist mehrfach zu einem der schönsten Ferienhöfe Deutschlands gewählt worden. Und zwar laden wir auf lange Wochenenden aus Geschichten, aus Lagerfeuer und Musik ein. Auf diesen Wochenenden, da könnt ihr mit Abenteurern, Fotojournalisten und den besten Vortragsreferenten Deutschlands durch ferne Landschaften und fremde Kulturen reisen, ganz ähnlich wie hier im Podcast, nur eben live. Ihr könnt dabei erlesene Weine genießen und die gute Küche eines spanischen Spitzenkochs, der dort vor Ort ist. Und ihr könnt gemütlich im Sofa packenden Interviews und Lesungen lauschen. Und natürlich auch die Weltenbummler selbst fragen in ganz privater Atmosphäre all das, was ihr schon immer einmal wissen wolltet. Ihr könnt in dieser wunderbaren Natur dort Wanderungen unternehmen, unternehmen und Lagerfeuer erleben und renommierte Jazzbands, die wir einladen. All das in kleiner, handverlesener Runde. Pro Ausgabe gibt es nämlich nur 50 Tickets. Die ersten Ausgaben finden Anfang August und Anfang September statt, 2020. Infos zu alledem, inklusive der konkreten Termine, findet ihr wie immer auf weltwach.de und dort unter Festival. So, und jetzt zu Laura Decker. Ich wünsche euch viel Spaß bei unserem Gespräch. Hi Laura, welcome to Unfolding Maps. I'm very pleased to have you.
Thank you.
Yes, we are sitting here in a little town. I think it's a town, right?
Yes.
It's not a city. It's not a village, yes. Something in between probably.
Yeah, probably.
In the north of the Netherlands. Can you, just to set the scene, can you tell our listeners a little bit about where we are and what we see when we look outside the window?
Oh, it's, I think it's just kind of a typical little Dutch town. Nothing special for me.
For me, it looks very cute. I just roamed around a little bit. And actually, I can see quite a few sailing boats from over here.
Yes, yes.
So we are close to the coast, of course.
Well, there's a lot of water in Holland.
So, yes, indeed.
There's
indeed.
Kind of boats everywhere. But
So are you here because of the boats? Are you here because you're doing some sailing?
Well, later on today, we might do some sailing.
Okay, so you still combine that with being here.
Yes, well, I try to sail as much as possible.
And that's, of course, what you also known for, no surprise. That's also why we are meeting here and what we are going to discuss. And what you are most well known for is your big trip around the world that you have done a few years ago, the youngest solo traverse around the world on an ocean with a sailing boat.
Yes.
And you did that from the age of 14 till 16, I think.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
What I would be interested in talking about first is to get an idea of how you got there, how you got to make this decision to go into onto such an adventure. So can you tell me a little bit about how you grew up?
It just slowly grew, actually. So I was born during the circumnavigation of my parents. They sailed around the world for 7 years. And I was born halfway. So I was born in New Zealand and grew up sailing with them and being on boats. So I started sailing from a very early age. And I was always quite inspired by the trip my parents took. So looking at their pictures and listening to their stories and then kind of slowly started to read more books of other people who did that. So then the idea came that I wanted to do that as well. But of course, like at this stage, I was probably like 8. I had no idea how or when I was going to do this. I just knew that one day I was going to do it. And I just started preparing for it because I figured it takes a lot of preparation and a lot of time and I will need money and a boat. So yeah, it just kind of slowly came together.
Do you know what specifically inspired you about the stories of your parents and about the famous sailors that you read the books from?
Mostly the people they met along the way. So the islands they went to and the cultures they saw, that was really fascinating to me, especially as a child. And that was also the reason why I decided not to go nonstop, but actually like make a lot of stops and just take my time to sail around the world, because it wasn't really about being the youngest. I just, like, at that stage, I just felt like I wanted to do that. And that just kind of came together with it. But especially when I sailed around it, I didn't really care too much. I just wanted to see the world. But then later on in my voyage, I also found that the being out at sea and having to do everything on my own, like, especially at this age that I did it, was actually very, like, worth a lot and very interesting as well. But that's an aspect that I hadn't seen beforehand.
Do you know how your parents actually got into sailing themselves and how they came up with the idea of sailing around the world for such an extended period of time?
Sure, yeah. So my granddad used to have a little boat and go sailing with the family. So my dad did kind of grow up sailing, although they weren't very serious and just kind of stayed on the lakes and the rivers and didn't go very far. My dad just took a liking to it and he started building boats when he was very little. So like when he was 7 or 8, he already built his first boats. And when he was around 12, he built a boat that he could actually live on and just started living on that boat. So he really, he really just wanted to see the world and go sailing already from a very early age. It was in his blood, I guess. Mm-hmm. So he started building the boat that my parents sailed around on when he was around 15. I think he actually started the plans. And he knew when the boat was ready, he was going to sail around the world. That was his dream. My mom isn't really a sailor, but they met while my dad was building the boat, and
so she had to go along.
She just kind of had to go
love it or leave
along.
It.
Yes.
And did she get into it a little bit?
No, she didn't. No,
wow.
She never.
But she accompanied him for 7 years.
Yeah, she did. Yeah, no, they did sail around the world together, but she never started to like sailing. It
that
was
must
more
have been tough.
Yeah, living on the boat, I guess, and seeing the cultures, like the way of traveling she really liked, but the sailing she never liked.
And how was it for you? Because you said you were actually born during this sailing around the world project. Probably most of your very early memories are really defined by ocean and water.
Yeah, definitely.
How was it to grow up on a small boat like this,
you know,
and keep moving?
Whenever, like when you're a kid, where you grow up and what you're doing is very normal and you don't even think about it. It's only now that I look back and think, okay, it was pretty unusual and pretty special, but that's not something I ever thought about when I was a kid. Like I didn't feel different or think it was special anyway. It was
you don't
just,
compare yourself.
You don't know, you don't. Like yeah. I think kids are just happy if they're with their parents and they're being loved, then that's pretty much all they need.
When you grew up, of course, it was normality for you. That was the status quo. You didn't know any other life.
Yeah.
So it felt totally normal. Can you still say or explain what the ocean back then meant to you? Would you have been fine just to leave it and now move to
no,
a city?
No, not at all.
It?
No, it was my home. Like, it felt like it was part of us, part of our family. It just needed to be there. I could not imagine having a youth like without water or sailing or ocean. It would have been totally wrong. I know at some stage when I was about 10 years old, we were living on the boat for my dad, and the council wanted us to leave and not live on the boat anymore, because even though a lot of people live on boats in Holland, actually often they don't like it and they're trying to get you off. So it's not easy. And I got really angry because I just could not imagine leaving the boat or living in a house. Like for me, it felt like they were putting me in a cage or having to go to prison or something. And I just couldn't accept it. So I was very furious. I was really angry that they were like trying to get us off the boat. So I started collecting signatures from people, and I got all the schools together, and I went to the council. And like
at the age of 10?
Yes.
Wow.
Yes.
That's very proactive.
I was yes.
Yeah, that must have been pleased.
He was definitely surprised.
Yes. So that already shows that you have been very proactive, that you just didn't wait for your parents to tell you what to do at a very young age.
Yeah.
And what do you think, when did it become apparent that you were also more curious, more adventurous than, in quotation mark, a normal girl at that age?
I think very early, very early on. Yeah, from like even when I started walking, I was gone all the time. I wanted to see everything and explore everything, and I wanted to do everything on my own. So, you know, I was learning something. I was like, no, I do it. I don't need any help. Very early on. And especially like when I started to make friends, it became very apparent for me that I was much more driven or determined to do the things that I wanted to do than most of my friends were. So even if we were just practicing for like a piece of music or song or something, I would easily go the whole day and just practice until it's perfect. Whereas my friends after an hour were like, okay, I'm done. I think that's just my character.
And did that already back then feel special to you, or didn't you even think about that?
I didn't think about it at all. I just found it very annoying that my friends like couldn't stick with it. I just couldn't understand why other people wouldn't have that. I think at that age, I was rather the difficulty that I could have a friend that had the same, that I could do the same things with. Yeah, that definitely made me do things more on my own.
And was there ever a point in your life where you seriously considered a future, professionally or personally, in which sailing wouldn't have played a very essential part?
No. I'm just thinking about like all the things that I thought about. It's like, no, there are always boats involved. I always knew I wanted to be like a captain or a skipper boats. Or...
And when did you, in fact, make the decision that you did want to become a serious sailor yourself?
I don't know if I ever made that conscious decision. I just knew.
It was a clear path.
It was clear that that was what I was doing.
And what were the steps for you to make that happen?
So when I was younger, I was racing in dinghies a lot. So I was just doing a lot of sailing races and kind of going up in that. But then at some stage, I came along a more seaworthy boat and I borrowed that for a little while and figured out, okay, this is actually really fun as well. Like I could sleep on it and go away for a weekend. And it kind of felt like it gave me a lot of freedom. And I kind of valued that more than the races. So that's how I kind of got into cruising or like longer sailing, not just day sails.
And how and when did the thought to sail around the whole world first cross your mind?
So I had sailed solo like around Holland and the lakes and the rivers and the North Sea and the islands. And after that, I figured I just kind of wanted to have a next step or a next adventure. So I sailed to England.
When was that?
I was 13 when I sailed to England. And I didn't tell anybody about it. So I was in England and then the police picked me up and my dad actually had to like get me from the police station.
How did he explain that to the policeman?
Well,
that he had to pick you up, his little girl. Everybody would think that anyway.
Yeah. Well, I had sailed there and I was there for a few days just staying on my boat and it was like a short school holiday. So I just wanted to go back again, you know, be back in time for school. I never saw the things that I did as being rebellious or going against things. I was like, for me, it was very logical. I had a good boat. I could sail. I knew what I was doing. Like, why?
Very confident
about it. Yeah, why would it be a problem for anybody? I just didn't see that it was a problem at all. So I'd sailed to England and and then the police just came and they said, okay, you know, somebody has like told us you're here alone. And is that true? And so I explained and I said, yes, I sailed here, but in a few days I will sail back to Holland and it's all fine. But obviously they didn't really like that explanation. So they took me to the police station and then called my dad and said, are you aware that your daughter is in England? She was like, nope, but good to know.
Were you in trouble with him?
No. Well, he was like a little bit angry, but not, I think, kind of more proud that
he's not a helicopter dad, I guess.
No, not really. He's actually, it's funny because I've thought about this a lot in the last years and especially the last year with now that I have an own little boy, and the way he taught me stuff is actually very interesting because a lot of people think that he was totally irresponsible or like a really bad dad. And also when I grew up, I really heavily felt the eyes of people on my dad thinking, okay, you know, here's a single father raising a daughter, like this can't be good. And I found that very, very crazy. And I still find it crazy that people think a dad can't raise children on his own. You know, it kind of seems weird. And then when I got the plan to sail around the world, a lot of people said, you know, this is crazy and these parents are crazy and he's such a bad parent and totally irresponsible. But the way I saw it then and the way I still see it and actually more and more clearly even is that he was super safety conscious. Like when I was a kid, I was not allowed to go anywhere without a life jacket. So I was like wearing a life jacket 24/7 basically because we were living on a boat. And whenever I went somewhere, he gave me like a phone very early on. And he said, just like call me every hour or send me a text message. I need to know where you are, what you are doing. And I do remember like forgetting it once and he already had called the police that I was missing and was very angry. And when I biked to school, I needed to wear a helmet and like one of these yellow jackets, which I really hated, of course, because everybody like,
it's not cool.
It's not really not cool. But it's interesting that actually he was very safety conscious, but in a way that he allowed me to do a lot of stuff while I was still within his safety and while he could teach me how I should deal with it. Whereas I think a lot of parents are just not allowing their kids to do anything. They're taking everything over. They're saying, no, you can't do that. It's dangerous. But then when they're like 16 or 17, they're going out on their own anyway, and then suddenly they have to learn all of these things they were never allowed to do. And I think the process of learning it then is so much tougher than when you learn it while you grow up. Plus that I had a lot of respect for my dad because he allowed me and he gave me the freedom that I wanted and I needed. But he did set up rules. So he was like, yeah, sure, you can go to your friend and stay overnight, but you are sending me a text message every hour. And if I didn't do that, it was over. Like, wasn't allowed to do it anymore. So I respected his rules and it worked very well. That way I trusted my dad and I had respect for him and he allowed me to do the things that I wanted.
And this way he built up your confidence, of course, but also his own confidence in you. And that's why he could let you do these things.
Yeah. And I find it so interesting. Like the more I think about it, I'm like, okay, yeah, I kind of understand why people think it was crazy because it's so out of the box and pretty much nobody does it like that. But it's such a cool way to teach a kid.
So when you had the thought to sail across the ocean and sail around the world, how did you start to act upon this plan or this idea and how did you turn it into a plan?
So I think unconsciously I started preparing for it when I was like 8 years old, just finding work, cleaning up shops and driving my unicycle around. And then obviously getting, like when I was 11, I got my first seaworthy boat. So I was like, okay, this boat's like giving me freedom. I can take it over an ocean. And just like asking my dad about anything I could think of, like navigation and sailing and places and reading. I read everything I could about traveling around the world. And yeah, just like that. it was my passion. It just like filled every day.
When did you feel ready?
So when I came back from England, I sailed back to Holland and it was actually quite a nice sailing trip. But the North Sea is just not nice place to sail, actually.
Why?
It's cold and there's a lot of ships and on this way back I was like, okay, like what am I gonna do next? I could like sail to England again, or I could go to Norway or France or something. But something inside of me said, okay, you can do that, but you could also just start sailing and you can go south and you could do a passage to France and back, or you could do a passage to France and then the next passage a little bit further. So then the idea really came into my head that I thought, well, why don't I just sail around the world now? Because why wouldn't I? I really couldn't actually find a reason not to do it.
So do you think you had that feeling to be ready and to not have a reason not to do it?
Yes.
Because you were so young, or despite the fact that you were so young?
That's a good question. I think both a little bit, because when you're young, and this is something I really like about kids, like you don't know what's waiting for you. So on the one hand, you're very optimistic, like it hasn't gone wrong before and it's not difficult. If I think now, I'm like, yeah, okay, but you know, it's going to be wet and you're going to be tired and it's tough. And like, do I really want to do that? But yeah, when you're that young, you don't know, and everything new thing is beautiful, so you didn't see that. But I also do think I really did feel that I was ready, and that was not a mistaken feeling, like because I was not knowing what I was getting into. I think I was definitely more enthusiastic about it because I didn't know what I was getting into. But I did have a good idea of what I was going to do.
And what did you think you would get out of the experience for yourself? So you had this longing, you had this inspiration, but just because you feel ready for something and you know you can do it or you could do it, doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do it or you should do it.
Right.
What was your best case hope?
Like what I was expecting.
Yes.
I wasn't actually expecting a whole lot, probably also because it's like really not much of an idea. I knew.
But you said you prepared a lot. You read a lot of books.
Yeah, I read a lot of books. So I was... I think that's also part of my character, that I always try not to expect too much, because then you can just get disappointed. I just gotta see what happens. But I did think that, you know, I wanted to see storms and calms and meet other people. I was so curious to see what the world was like, what other cultures and countries were like. And yeah, that was what I was mostly looking forward to. And I guess having my own freedom, like deciding my own life, how I was going to deal with stuff on my own. That was pretty exciting too. And kind of scary.
Was your dad scared when you told him about the idea? How did he react?
It's an interesting thing, because he never ever showed that he was nervous or scared or anything like that while I was sailing around. But now he does admit that he was scared sometimes and and nervous and didn't like it. But at the time, he didn't show it to me at all. In the beginning, he kind of didn't take it very serious and said, yeah, sure, you know, if you can organize everything yourself, then he couldn't go into riots, and he didn't really think it was going to happen that way.
I think it's pretty impressive because he supported you a lot in the next month or however long this process of planning and making it more specific took. And I think it's really amazing because you already said, yeah, he was, by then he raised you on his own.
Mm-hmm.
And of course he was, you already said it as well, people are a little bit skeptical of dads raising their, mm-hmm. their kids on their own. And now he intended to let you go onto this massive trip.
Right.
And of course, opening himself up to a lot of criticism
yeah.
for this decision alone, but don't even think about if something would have happened. People would
I
have
wonder
said
if he
is so irresponsible.
Really thought about that. Like, yeah. I definitely didn't see it coming.
Yeah.
But I don't think he did either, because the way my dad and I grew up, like both of us, even for his childhood, were so used to being on boats and being on water and traveling alone from an early age. And I think both my dad and I are quite we're quiet people who like to kind of do things by themselves, and but we're definitely safety conscious and doing everything well prepared. So for us it was logical, and we didn't think people would think it was weird. So I actually honestly think like he didn't see it coming either.
So probably it was more like if I would have asked my mom to be allowed to go onto a long distance hike or something throughout Europe or
yeah.
maybe even further.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Like for us it was super normal, and he probably would have expected some criticism, but then we were used to that just because of the way we lived anyway.
Yes.
And
so some criticism came from your mom. How did she deal with the idea?
Yeah, I think that partly because she doesn't like sailing, it would have been a lot harder for her to understand why I wanted to do it anyway. Like, why would you go sit on a boat and be seasick and wet and stinky and salty? That's like really not a fun thing to wish your daughter. But yeah, it was a bit hard because I hadn't grown up with her and I hadn't seen her a lot. So she also didn't really know what I was capable of or what I had been doing, how hard I had been working for it. And suddenly she was kind of dragged into the whole discussion as well and being asked, like, what do you want? Are you going to say yes or no? And she didn't really want to say no because she wanted to support me and be on my side. But she did say, yes, of course, I'm nervous. And of course, I don't want her to go. But, you know, like, what's the best thing to do as a parent?
And you said she got dragged into the whole discussion. And that, of course, means not only the discussion between you and your dad, but there was a much bigger discussion going on eventually.
Yes, yes, definitely.
What was that like?
It was very strange because it kind of became a discussion topic about what you are allowing your children and how you raise your children and what is too young to do certain things. And this discussion wasn't about me. It was started by me, but it wasn't about me.
And you're talking about a discussion in the whole media, right?
Exactly. And it kind of became this worldwide discussion, or especially in Europe,
I remember it
really high. Yeah. But it was strange because it was kind of done over my head. So the discussion wasn't about me, but it was my name that was being used, my picture, my trip. And I, at some stage, didn't even really feel like a person anymore. I was just this discussion object, and people don't realize anymore, I think, that that was actually like a real person behind it, or a real family that was fighting for something, that was stuck in the middle of this bubble that everybody had an opinion about. And it's very strange to be in that spot where you're in the middle of the spotlights, basically, but you're actually nothing.
Because your specific and individual experiences, for example, didn't matter at all, I think, right?
No, not at all. And also just the things that people say, like the comments that they make to me or to my family or write about, or just it's crazy. It's like they don't even think about that this person might also read it and have feelings. It's like they just think, oh, you know, these people don't have feelings. They're just discussion objects. It's very strange.
What do you think provoked this strong, multinational, almost global reaction?
Yeah, it's a good question.
Because if it was not really about you, then it must have been about something else.
Yeah, well, the topic of raising children and how you raise them and what age you're going to let kids do something is of course always a big discussion object, and it's, I believe, in Europe gone way too far where, you know, the adult age is even being raised to like being 21 or something, and it's a big thing here with helicopter parents, and then doing something on your own at 13 is, of course, a really big shock.
I mean, to have a discussion in a society about an issue like that, of course, I think is okay. You can talk about it. So what about it was so hurtful for you?
The fact that people don't thought about my feelings and just say, oh, you know, these are bad parents and she's going to sink and she's just a spoiled brat. And people say stuff without thinking that there is a person behind it or what it would do to that person. And I kind of see the same thing happening to Greta at moments. I think this is very comparable. She has done something that was her dream that like she believes in, and she started it, and it's taken by the world and made a massive discussion topic, which is like everywhere. And they forget that there's still a girl behind it that has feelings. And I read on the internet stuff that I think, well, this is like, that's some heavy stuff that they also wrote about me, and I know how it feels, and I know she reads it, and it's very painful where she has a dream and she's just being used by the world, basically.
Yeah, you become like a projection object for all kinds of opinions about general topics like climate change in this case.
And I do believe that she had no idea like what she was stepping into, just like I did. And it's crazy how people have opinions about everything, and they need to yell it out. The need to just write her opinion everywhere and say it. And it's... that was definitely a big shock. Like it's a big whirlwind into people's characters, actually.
And it took a lot of energy because there were, I think, like 6 or 8 court cases in the Netherlands trying to stop you from going, but you won them eventually.
Yes.
And finally, we don't have to discuss this in great detail, but you got through it. But it cost a lot of energy. There was a lot of media attention, and it wasn't a nice time for you, I think. But eventually... Yeah. You got through it and you were able to set sails and to embark on the journey. Did your dad give you any like last advice or any like preconditions for really letting you go?
Well, he was mostly concerned about me going on land.
Okay, that's interesting.
So he wasn't, you know, the sailing, he believed I could sail and deal with anything that was coming on the way there. But he did have a rule, and that was that I wasn't really allowed to go on land by my own. So he said, you know, you have to anchor where other boats are anchored and go and make friends with like another couple. And then you go shopping with them and go and explore the country with them. But just don't go anywhere alone because it's not really needed. You know, you just make friends. And that's something he was, I think, mostly concerned about, just going on land, because that's something I really wanted to do. You know, I wanted to see the countries and the people. So that was his only rule.
Did you have any concerns when preparing something you really paid a lot of attention to increase your safety or, you know, even to increase the pleasure you would get out of the trip?
Right. I think I concentrated mostly on the boat and its systems. So making sure the boat was safe and all the safety gear was good, and like I knew how to deal with it and how to repair it.
What kind of boat was it?
It was a 38-foot catch. So she was...
Can you explain a little bit?
Yeah, she was from 1978. She was definitely not a young boat, but made from polyester, which is pretty durable. So it was a good boat, and she was a racer cruiser back in the days anyway. Today we'd probably more call it a cruiser, although she was still a very fast boat. And definitely a wet boat as well. That means like even when there's just 50 knots of wind, there was just water coming over. With race boats these days, there's water coming over much sooner. And she was pretty simplistic, so I didn't have a shower on board or a fridge or anything like that, which I didn't mind, actually. You get used to it very quickly. And she had 2 masts, so that was actually quite good because both of the masts are a little bit smaller than if you would have 1 mast. So the sails are actually smaller, and it makes it much easier for me to handle.
How do you remember the day you started the journey?
It was a mixture of like every single emotion you could probably have. I was super happy and really nervous. And I was missing my family and I was wondering what the hell I was doing. But at the same time, so it was like the happiest day in my life, probably. But at the same time, I was just so nervous. And like, yeah, it's so hard to explain.
Of course, we cannot talk about the whole journey. That would take by far too much time. And there's also a book about it. But could you give me a little kind of summary? So what was your general route and how long did the journey take?
Yeah, sure. So I started from Gibraltar and then Canary Islands, Cape Verde, and then across the Atlantic Ocean to the Caribbean through the Panama Canal. And then across the Pacific, basically stopping at various islands, going to north of Australia, to Darwin. And then from Australia, I sailed straight to South Africa. And from South Africa, straight to back to the Caribbean. And then, so this is kind of where like the official start and ending point was, because that's where my lines crossed. I'd been in the Caribbean before. And anyhow, at that stage, I decided not to sail back to Holland and continued sailing again through the Panama Canal and across the Pacific to New Zealand.
How long did that take all in all?
Everything together, about 2 years.
Do you know how much of that time you spent on the water? Because you spent a lot of time on land as well.
Yeah, so like from the Caribbean to the Caribbean was about 7 months, I think, on the water.
That's a lot. So yeah, what
a sailboat is not the fastest thing to take if you want to get somewhere.
What was a typical day on board like? How can I imagine you spending your time?
It changes every day, basically. Sailing is so much listening to the weather and... It's everything depends on the wind and the waves and the sea state at the moment. But it always involved taking 1 hour naps, because longer than 1 hour, I could never sleep. So whenever I could, so whether that was at night or during the day, if there was like 1 hour of not much happening, I would sleep. And the rest of the time, I read a lot. And if it was somewhat quiet, I would play the guitar or write. Or do my schoolwork. I looked out at the ocean a lot and was just thinking, and then of course adjusting the sails and navigating and cooking. And yeah,
some people who are not into sailing at all and need to be busy all the time, they might wonder, was it boring? Well, I'm pretty sure it wasn't boring for you, because sailing is what you love and what you live and breathe.
Yeah, of course.
What is like your state of mind when you are like watching the ocean and listening to the wind?
I obviously grew up on a boat and sailing, so it's pretty much just a continuance of what I had been doing all my life anyway. And no, I didn't think it was boring. I always am surprised by how fast the days go by and like how much there actually is to do. But that probably depends on people as well. Like my mom always thought I was really boring. And I love it, every bit of it.
Gleich geht's weiter mit dem Gespräch. Wir unterbrechen ganz kurz für einen Hinweis auf unseren Sponsor AV Stumpfel, ein österreichisches Unternehmen, das sich mit seiner Software Wings dem Ziel verschrieben hat, mit Bildern Geschichten zu erzählen. Die aktuelle Version, Wings 7, ist das perfekte Werkzeug, um mit wenigen Klicks eine zeitgemäße Multimedia-Slide- oder Diashow zu kreieren. Wings 7 ist zwar nicht ausschließlich im Hinblick auf Videoschnitt hin konzipiert worden, aber man kann auch Videomaterial professionell und effektiv sichten, framegenau schneiden und verarbeiten. Wenn ein Video in einem externen Schnittprogramm optimiert wird, dann führt das oft zu lästigem Zwischenrendern, was nicht nur sehr zeitraubend, sondern auch qualitätsmindernd ist. Mit den non-destruktiven Echtzeiteffekten von Wings 7 geht das sehr viel schneller und ist vor allem verlustfrei. Bilder werden bei der Wiedergabe in Wings nicht in ein Videoformat umgewandelt und somit bleibt die maximale Bildqualität und Farbtiefe erhalten. Auf der offiziellen Website www.wings7.at findet ihr alle Informationen über Wings und erhaltet beim Kauf einer neuen Vollversion 5% Rabatt. Schreibt dazu einfach Weltwach 2020 in das Feld Bemerkung des Bestellformulars und AV Stumpfel berücksichtigt euren Rabatt dann auf der Rechnung. Und jetzt zurück zu unserem Gespräch. And you said you, of course, had to really manage your sleep 1 hour at a time, because you have to make sure you're still, you know, going in the wrong into the right direction and all the winds are still good and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So was there a time when you couldn't sleep for a lengthy period of time because of conditions?
Yeah, definitely. Like sometimes I couldn't sleep for a day or 2 days maximum because there was just too much going on.
How connected did you feel to the outside world while you were traveling on the boat?
Not at all.
Because there was no connection, right?
No, there was not a connection. And I love that. In the beginning, I found it hard because I missed my family and I wanted to talk to them. But eventually, I realized it's actually a really beautiful thing. Because if I would have been connected, I think I wouldn't have learned to let it go and actually enjoy the moment that I'm in. I would have always try to stay in contact and write and
not really detach yourself.
Yeah,
from
you
it.
Don't really detach yourself. So no, I didn't feel connected, and that felt really good.
And how was it with the boat, the emotional connection to the boat? Was it a tool of transportation? Like, I think about my car, you know, it helps me, I like it, but I don't really need it. I could also use another car, doesn't matter. So how was that?
No, my boat is definitely, like, it became my best friend. In a way, you know, I wouldn't be able to do it without the boat, and the boat wouldn't be able to do it without me. And I never talked to myself, but I definitely talked a lot to the boat.
Really?
And,
did it have a name?
Yeah.
Of course, she
was called Guppy.
Guppy, yes.
And she was very special to me, yeah.
And I think you didn't only listen to the wind, you were also able to listen to the boat, right? You really understood it so well that you really could feel or hear when something was wrong.
Definitely.
Do you have an example of that?
So sometimes I would be sleeping, and in my sleep, I would hear a sound of, you know, like either the waves being a little bit different on the boat, and I would just wake up and instantly know, okay, we've shifted course, or something broke, or I would just from the little changes in how the boat was moving or the sounds that were on it, I knew what was going on with her and what direction we were sailing or if I needed to look or not. You become very, very connected. If I would go to sleep, I would just like take in every single sound and kind of go to sleep with that. And when it changes, you just wake up and you know it's that you need to do something.
How often did you go on land? Every chance you got? Or did you try to maximize the time on the boat?
In the beginning, yes. I went on land a lot. And it kind of got less and less during the trip because I just started to really value the time on sea as well. And I wanted to do some longer stretches. So like from Darwin to South Africa, I didn't stop at all, even though there's islands. And the same from South Africa to the Caribbean, I didn't stop just because I wanted to do those longer voyages.
How long did these lengthy trips?
The longest was 48 days.
48 days?
Yes.
Only on the ocean?
Yes.
That's a lot. So you had all the food, everything for 48 days?
The whole lot of pasta.
Wow, so healthy.
Yeah, not really.
So of course, that's a very typical question, but still interesting. What were the most difficult or toughest moments?
So probably the whole battle before the trip.
Yes.
That was the toughest, definitely. And actually starting out, like actually leaving, I think that's always hard. Whenever you go on an adventure, those first steps are the toughest. And the first crossing, because I still just needed to learn so much about myself and the boat and how to find the right routine and how I wanted to do things.
So that means, because you said for you it felt so natural to do this sailing around the world adventure, because that's what you've been doing all your life, but it didn't feel that natural. So it still felt like some obstacle you had to overcome. It still felt like a challenge.
Of course, yeah. Everywhere where you sail, it's different and the weather systems are different. And the boat that I took wasn't the boat that I wanted to take originally. I wanted to take a 7-meter boat that I had for many years that I knew inside out. And the court decided that I needed to have a bigger boat. So, yeah, we got that. But obviously, I didn't know this boat inside out. So I still had quite a learning process with the boat while I was going on. And I don't think I would have had that with the other boat.
Were there any storms or any challenges like this?
Definitely. Yeah, quite a few storms, especially in the Indian Ocean. But I'm always quite down to earth and don't try to blow things up and try to see it coolly. But yeah, it definitely did have some big storms.
And the big whale encounter once, right?
Yes. It's around South Africa. There's a lot of whales. And one whale just kind of dove up right next to the boat and gave me quite a shock because they're pretty big animals. They're actually bigger than the boat. So if they bump into it or just kind of try to give it a hug or something, that boat probably wouldn't like that. So I was slightly nervous.
Were there any encounters that come to mind that meant a lot to you on land?
Yeah, definitely. I met so many people that I've learned a lot from. And just the way they live, like living in these little huts and simply just being so happy with the things they have, whereas I've seen so many people that, to our Western standards, don't have anything, you know, little huts and a mattress and some food from the land and water from a waterfall. And like they don't have anything according to our standards yet. For their standards, they've got everything they need and they're really happy and really content. And I found that really beautiful to see. Just the way these people live and the way they treat other people. They have a lot of respect and a lot of things that I think we've kind of lost here.
So did you try to take some of that impression back
with
you?
Definitely. Yeah, there's a lot of lessons that I think I've learned, like that happiness doesn't come from having stuff or materialistic things, but mostly from valuing the things you've got and simply just being happy with what you've got and looking at things positively instead of negatively, which is what we do here a lot. Those are things that I've definitely learned from the people along the way because I've seen it with my own eyes, and that's something very special.
Are you able to say what the most beautiful moments for you have been on this whole journey?
The most beautiful days were either when I was sitting somewhere on a beach with a local learning how to fold a palm hedge or or make a certain kind of fruit the way they do it. But also, I remember very well like a night where there was absolutely no wind and the stars were reflecting into the ocean, and it kind of feels like you're sailing through space or something with stars above you and under you, and they're all so bright. Or the boat smashing through a storm in full moon while phosphorescence is just all around the boat, glowing up green. There's such special moments that even if there's really bad moments, that there are, and you know, there were definitely moments that I thought, why am I here? But then there's those little moments that often only take half an hour or something that are so special that just makes everything good.
And they will stay with you forever.
They stay with me forever. Yes. Yeah. And they're worth much more than anything else, I think.
Many years ago, in 2014, you said in an interview, arriving at the end of this journey did feel like the end of a dream and the beginning of your life.
Yes.
I don't know if you still remember that specific quote, but probably you do remember the feeling behind it, right?
Yeah.
So arriving and looking back, having proven that you could do it, do you remember what that was like for you?
Yeah, definitely. So It is like I said in the quote, it was, you know, the trip around the world was a dream. And like I said earlier, I didn't really do it because of the age record. So arriving back for me wasn't that special. Like for the world, it was special because it kind of solved this huge discussion of whether a 13-year-old could do it or not, which seemed to be pretty important to the world. But obviously, it was just not important to me. I think... Now, looking back, now that I'm much older, I think, okay, I can understand and see why people thought like that. But yeah, at that time, I didn't see it at all. Like, I didn't really care about it or took it very serious.
So after 2 years, the media was still pretty interested,
yeah,
right? The topic
was
not that. So it was.
Yeah, definitely. But then obviously, like, this dream that I had was over, but then I had learned so much from the trip itself that I really felt like, okay, like, now I know what the world is like, what the people in it are like, and all the doors are open. Like, I can make my own life and choose where I want to go because I've learned and seen this.
And how far did that impact your decisions? Which kind of decisions did you make?
Everything, I think. Like, I don't know how I would be if I hadn't done the trip, but I do feel like it was a life changer in every sense of the word.
So how did the years following the trip unfold for you? Was there any emptiness because you had to search for a new project, a new vision that you could really identify with? Or
yeah, not really.
Was a new path
I'm
created?
The kind of person who wakes up in the morning and has like a million things that I want to do and have no idea where to start. So I generally start doing like five things at the same time. And obviously that doesn't work. So then I narrow it down. And I've always had that. So I headed after the trip as well. I knew I wanted to go to New Zealand. So that obviously was my next goal. Then when I was in New Zealand, I knew, okay, now I need to... I didn't think that the effects of my voyage would drag out so long. Like, I'm still getting presentations and people are still interested, even 10 years after. And I had never thought that would happen. So when I came in New Zealand, my next thing was like, okay, I need to build up a future. I need to have something that I can work with when all this is worn off. And So I got my captain's license and I started working, found a job, found a place for my boat, lived on the boat. I did do some traveling and then I finished writing my books, of course. So like first I did it in Dutch and then it was translated into German and then into English. So that was quite a lot of work to like be in all those processes. Yeah. And then I started working with a school as well, like in the outdoor education. And I figured out that I actually really like working with kids and that I love kind of telling them my stories and the things that I had learned that I think are really important for them to know or to learn at some stage. So then the idea of my foundation kind of slowly set in, I guess. And it was in my head for a long time, but I didn't really do anything with it.
Until
some time ago, I decided, you know, why don't I actually make this actually happen?
So what is the idea behind the foundation?
Yeah, so the idea is that I really like to take groups of kids so that are my age when I sailed around the world, so like 14, 15, 16, onto a ship and actually let them do pretty much the same things that I had to do. Sail the boat, go through a storm, cook for themselves, clean up and get the boat somewhere. And obviously, you know, I and the crew are there if it really goes wrong, because not everybody grew up sailing and could do that. But I do think and actually know that it will teach them some very important values that I think aren't taught in schools or really in the world today, or could take a very long time to learn. Yeah, things like teamwork or just fighting through hard times or having discipline, knowing how to reach your own dreams and your own goals. And most importantly, I think getting to know yourself, like who am I really? Because if you're in school, I've also been in school before I started homeschooling, you're very much pushed into being somebody that you're not. And I have always been a bit different and a bit stubborn in that sense and stick to myself. But I do see a lot of kids who have trouble with that. And it's a shame that they lose sense of themselves or who they really are. And it generally takes up until their end 20s or mid 30s until they actually figure out, you know, I didn't do the things that I wanted to do and I always followed other people. And that's something very important to give to kids. I think that especially in this developmental stage where you're finding yourself and finding your pathway in life, to have somebody who encourages you to actually be yourself and that it's okay to be yourself and how to reach your own dreams and goals.
And how far do you think the school system works against that or is not helpful in that?
Like because 100% goes against it, I think. Like it's so theoretical and I understand why the school system would want to box everybody, because it's much easier to rule people that are all doing the same thing, that are all going the same way. So, you know, if you're making a system and ruling a country or people, then that seems to be the logical way to go. But then it does make people very depressed and unhappy, which obviously results in a lot of really bad things happening. And I think that's partly due because in schools you're being taught you need to get good notes and you need to study and you need to find a good job, you need to make a lot of money. And the untrue statement behind it, kind of always lingering through, is that when you reach all that, you're going to be happy, which obviously isn't true. But how would you know until you've gone through the whole thing, which most people do, and then find out in their late 30s that actually didn't make them happy and they finally start doing the things they want. But I think you could actually do that much earlier and it would make for a much happier society.
I'm just thinking about it because I used to spend quite a bit of time on a farm in Australia, more than 1 year all in all. And the topic of that farm is like back to basics, teaching practical living skills. The farmer, he's an old guy, he's like 75 now or something like that. It's very basic. The accommodation is without electricity and running water, very basic. And his whole philosophy, he also used to work for the government earlier on, years ago. But he also thinks, yeah, we have to get the children out of the city, basically, and give them the chance to really work with tools, build some, you know, catch a fish, whatever. Just really, really, really basic stuff that they are not...
There's kids that are really happy being in that box, that are happy learning and studying and following that way. And that's good, you know, they should do it. But if I look in my class, there were probably like four or five kids who really enjoyed learning. the rest of them were over it, stuck with it. They didn't like it. They wanted to do something else. And they were basically being held from popping out to be themselves. And that resulted in a lot of frustration and cropped up, like, things that they wanted to do that they weren't allowed to do. So, yeah. So some people fit it and most others don't.
So when is the right time to allow the kids to really unfold themselves and to follow their own instincts and passions?
Well, that's where we go back to this whole discussion.
Exactly.
Basically, like, what is too young, or at what age do you start doing something? And this is an interesting discussion because I don't think there is a rule. There is no rule for it. The beautiful thing about people is that everybody's different and everybody's got their own things that they're good at and their own, they're following their own schedule. But it's up to the parents, and this is why being a parent is such an important job that shouldn't be taken lightly, and I think is very often. There's no set of rules for your kids. Every child is different. So whereas I was ready very early to do things because I understood dangers, and this is a very important thing. For an example, very close to me, my sister, she had, like, she didn't even want to. When she was 16 or 17, she just started going, like, okay, maybe I want to do something on my own now. But it's so important to spend time with your kids and get to know them and know where their limits are, know what they're capable of. And, of course, overcoming your own fear of, like, I want to protect him, I want him to stay with me, I don't want him to do that. That's a very difficult thing as a parent, I think, to let your kids go and know when to let them go. And this can be with 6, or it can be with 13, or it can be with 18. It's so different. Everybody's really different. I don't think there's a rule for it.
And you said earlier on, what you are trying to do with your foundation is to help the kids to find their own path,
yes,
to happiness.
Yeah.
How
basically.
It sounds a little bit cheesy.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yes, yes, yes. but it's okay for now.
Sure.
But how does that work? So we understood, like, in school, it's a little bit boxed in and so on. How does it work, for example, on a boat? How can that help the process?
The perfect thing
for a kid that hasn't grown up on a boat.
Exactly. So the perfect thing from a boat is that it just guaranteed throws you into shitty situations. Like, even if you're not going through a massive storm, it's going to be tough because you're never going to get more than an hour's sleep. Maybe if there's more people, it might be a little bit longer, but more than 3 hours, pretty much no chance. And you're going to have to, like, cook while a boat is going over waves. It's like trying to cook in a roller coaster. You're going to have to shower and go to the toilet and clean up, and you're going to have to work with other people. And there's also camps for doing this, but the cool thing on a boat is that it's a real serious situation. There's no calling mommy to come and pick me up. There's no I'm going home now. There's no I'm going to sit in my tent and be grumpy now. Because if you do that, serious things are going to happen. There's serious consequences to everything. Being on a boat is probably the quickest way to just throw yourself into a real life survival situation where you just, like, simply have to. And that's what I love about sailing, that it just pushes me to my limits and it challenges me every time. And that's something that we need as a we just need to be challenged, because that's the way we learn and we grow and we develop ourselves.
And your reaction to these challenges has always been, very proactive, very positive and empowering.
I've definitely been cursing at the waves and angry at everything. No, definitely, and I'm not expecting this to be a pleasure trip or be easy. I'm actually thinking, this is going to be really hard, and I'm going to be kids that are going to be angry at me, that I throw them into this. They're going to be angry at everything. And
have you done something like this before?
A little bit. So I haven't done trips? I've done smaller trips.
So how were the reactions of the kids in these situations?
Pretty similar. But I think the effect will be much more long lasting if it's a long trip. So the short trips, it might stay with them a little bit. But on the longer trips, there's actually, like, no phone, just being totally disconnected. I think it will have a much deeper impact, because I had for me as well. I felt like if I was at sea for a week, it was it was just not enough time to really get into rhythm and really let everything go. Whereas if I was at sea for 2 or 3 weeks, I was able to just let it go and be on the boat and accept everything. And that's the stage that I want them to get to.
But not only for one trip, but you want to do that continuously and repeatedly, right? That's
yes,
the idea.
But yes, different, with different groups of
yes,
kids.
Yes, of course. Yes, yes. And exactly. What kind of trips would that be?
Anything. My ultimate would be to replicate my journey around the world and take groups of kids like on the different okay. stages of that journey. But it can be anywhere in the world, basically. Yeah.
One thing that I think can be really taught well on a situation like this, on a boat like this, in a situation like this, is also courage, right? Because you said before, not courage just to deal with immediate danger, but you said you want to help the children to find out who they really are and to discover their passions and to maybe then follow their passions
right.
early on, and not only when they are 30 and after they have studied for 10 years or something. And I think courage is a very important factor in terms of making life decisions that enable you to follow your passions. Because many people who are 30 or 40 know their passions, but still don't follow them because of so many reasons and a completely new set of boxes that they have been put in. How do you think about that? About this factor of, well, okay, you can help the kids to maybe find out what they like, and maybe they find out, oh yeah, I like sailing, I like practical things.
Courage is, it's not something that I'm going to be able to give them. It's something that they are going to have to work for. It's also not something that you have or you don't have. I think it's something everybody has to learn. And it's funny because I was not a very courageous kid. I was just very driven. And because I really, really wanted to do something, I overwhelmed my fears and started doing it. But not everybody has that, and I think everybody has their own path to being courageous. But since it is a learning process for everybody, I think if they have gone through a few difficult things and found out, okay, you know, I survived this, I can do this, I did this on my own, those are the first steps to trusting yourself and trusting that you're actually capable of more than you think, and eventually being courageous enough to keep doing that. I'm still like the foundation I have, that there's so many unknown factors and so many things that I don't know of. Obviously, I'm good with sailing and I love working with kids, but setting it up and the whole kind of business behind it is a totally unknown world to me. I think I've gone through enough situations to just trust myself and kind of go, well, okay, I have to try. I have to do it. What's the worst thing that can happen?
And I think these are also the thoughts that you had when we were 13 or 14 and eventually made the decision to sail across the world.
Yeah, definitely.
And back then you felt ready to do it. How is it today? Does the way you feel ready and you know that you are ready for something new, has it changed? Or is it still like more or less the same?
I haven't had it quite as clearly. It's like when I sailed around, I was so determined and I felt really ready. Like I just knew I had to do it, as if something was just inside of me pushing me that, yes, now you're going to do it. I think I don't have it quite as much. Of course, sometimes I have doubts or fears or with things. But in a certain way, yes, it's still there. Like I still know pretty well where I am going and what it is that I have to do next. Even if I don't really know how I'm going to do it, I do know where I have to go.
And what is it? What are you going to do next? Meaning, what are the next steps for the next 1 or 2 or 3 years in terms of the foundation?
Getting the money together to build the boat, basically. So yeah, getting the boat together and setting it all up. Those are the main steps.
Is there any way our listeners can follow this kind of journey?
Yeah,
that
definitely.
You're on
so
right
we've
now?
Got we've got a Facebook page called the Laura Decker World Sailing Foundation.
We will link that, of course. Yes.
On which I should be posting much more, but that's like one of my. I'm really bad at this, but I'm working on it. I'm working on getting better at the social media and updating people. Yeah. Anyhow, there's some updates on it, and my website. Same story. But there's definitely a lot of information on the website. So telling what I want to do and where we're going and what the ship is going to be like. So, and I do have a YouTube channel. And once we're building the boat or obviously starting with the project, there will be videos and more updates on that.
Very nice. I will look out for it and link to it.
And
thank you.
I look forward to joining the journey by following it. So
thank you very much.
I wish you all the best for it. And I thank you very, very much for taking the time.
That's Thanks. Right.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Das war mein Gespräch mit Laura Decker. Ich hoffe, es hat euch gefallen. Wenn ihr jetzt noch nicht völlig abgestoßen seid von meinem leicht deutschen Akzent im Englischen, dann würde ich mich freuen, wenn ihr, so ihr es noch nicht getan habt, jetzt direkt in eurer Podcast-App auf Unfolding Maps geht, beziehungsweise das sucht und abonniert. Dann habt ihr nämlich noch mehr solcher wunderbaren Interviews vor euch. Und nicht vergessen, schaut gern mal auf der Website weltwach.de vorbei unter Festivals oder auch Events, um zu schauen, ob nicht vielleicht ein Weltwach-Event oder sogar das Festival für euch in Frage kommt. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören und bis bald. Ciao.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.